You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here, and welcome back to another episode. So the episode today is actually the fifth episode in our seven-part series on Elevate Your Flip. Now, give you a quick recap on where we are in here. The previous episode, we talked about the big four of figuring out how much you need to spend on your property and starting to create the statement of work. And now we're going to continue that discussion from looking at a townhome and now to do a full-on single-family home here. And I've got Derek Marlin, who is the president of Elevation, who's going to walk us through here. So, Derek, good to have you back.
Chris, thanks for having me.
So, refresh my memory and bring everyone else up to speed as well, because I know as we go through these episodes, we all have a lot of stuff going on in our lives. We hear different information. So in the big picture of the five episodes we've gone through, where does this fall into it? And then secondly, where does this fall into the project management portion?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are still ideally in the phase that we're doing tons of due diligence and tons of work up front before we actually close on the property. This part, episode number five, where we get into a more detailed statement of work, which in this specific instance, we'll go through a single family home. And then what are we doing for our fixtures and finishes? This is right on the cusp of pre-closing. That's the best case scenario. Sometimes closing happens and you are finalizing this within the next day or two from purchasing the property, but right on that tipping point of about to purchase. But in a perfect world, you've already done all your due diligence and you're ready to buy before we get the project started.
And when you say ready to buy, so we are past our inspection objection or inspection termination part of the contract. So we're committed, or at least your earnest money is committed.
Yeah, good point. Your earnest money is committed, and ideally you should be 100% committed to this project. In episode four of going through the budget and a statement of work, you've already narrowed down what your overall budget's going to be and ideally which contractor you're going to use. And then in this episode, we'll talk about a more detailed statement of work, but you have selected that contractor and you're putting all the finishing touches on contractually committing to a specific contractor. And again, the goal is if you close on a Wednesday, let's say, and purchase the property, that you've got your roll off hitting that day and you're going to start, or within at least 1 or 2 days afterwards, not wait, buy the property and then get started on all this planning, because you're going to lose at least probably 1 to 2 weeks, if not more.
All right. So I know we're going to do the statement of work for a single family home.
Yep.
So we're going to go to the different spreadsheet for your single family home statement of work.
Correct.
But is your initial expense estimator, that's the same for attached or detached properties, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So in the prior episode, to put it kind of from a 30,000 foot perspective, we've gone through, we've analyzed the deal. We've known that it's going to be a good deal on paper. We've inspected the property and used our one sheet budget estimator to do all your circles and your tally marks to determine how much is this project going to cost. Again, that gets us about 90 to 95% of the way there on budgeting the cost for the project. You've then taken the third step and put together a one-page budget that is line items that we went through in episode number four that really says, okay, we're going to do, whether it's a simple condo or whether it's an involved single-family home. We even use this for small multifamilies as well. But, 15 to 25 line items of what are we going to do and what's our bottom line number, sharing that with your contractor so that you can not only employ that push pricing strategy to tell people you know what you're doing, you know you're in the ballpark. It helps you narrow down which contractor you want to use. And now we're to the point where we're doing our detailed statement of work, which in this episode, we're going to go through room by room basis, how we outline a project and how we work on a project. So you're really looking from an evaluation perspective, committing on the deal, budgeting the deal, to now the nitty gritty of what's going to happen in every single room of a project. And our last step, that people see on our webinar, but is our fixture and finish package. And that is not only what are we doing in each room, but what style are we going to translate to how we're fixing up this house to appeal to the widest audience to sell it on the back end.
Great. Yeah. Well, let's jump into it.
Yeah, so let's jump into that spreadsheet.
I enjoyed it last time, so I'm looking forward to seeing how you break it down on this time.
Perfect. So what we do is we start out, we're going to walk through a spreadsheet that we use at Elevation. And we work our way from the outside of the home in. And again, this is more so with your single family home where you really need to look at every single aspect of that specific property. So major systems, which if we think back to from a budgeting perspective, this is where we determine this is probably where you're going to spend probably 60 or so percent of your budget. You outline the major areas. So for us, we put together, what are we going to do in the basement? What are we going to do in the crawl space? What do we have going on from major systems perspective? So that's your furnace and your AC, your hot water heater, your windows, your sewer line, and your roof. So again, you kind of work from the outside of the home in. And the way that we've got our spreadsheet set up is if you're reading from left to right, and again, I always try to think of people listening to this in their car that don't have our spreadsheet pulled up as you're driving, hopefully, but you've got really detailed descriptions of where's the work happening, the location, who's doing the work. So we've got another column for whether it's a general contractor or a subcontractor, and then who's providing the materials. So big picture perspective, for example, the furnace and the AC is in this specific project, which was for a single family home in a southern Denver suburb of Littleton, Colorado. We were doing a new furnace and we were adding some new return air. So there's a description and a note under each major section that really tells exactly what you're doing from a major systems perspective.
Okay.
So again, you're kind of talking about furnace, you're talking about hot water heater, you're talking about windows. And a good example is if we look at windows and it's in these notes, and we do this a lot, is replace all the windows in the house except a window in the garage. Because kind of a little pointer is you don't usually get a lot of bang for your buck for having one small new window in your garage when I'd rather spend that money in other areas. But your contractor would never know that if you said, hey, I've got budget for all the windows. You need to put that in there except this specific window. Mm. Or we're going to add an egress window in the southwest corner of, you know, a specific bedroom. So we really need to make sure these are clear so that you don't show up and you've got an egress window in the wrong part of the house. So super important.
You don't want them cutting the foundation in the wrong spot.
Yep, exactly. So we work from kind of, again, an outside in perspective. So your first tab is the major systems. Then we go to the actual exterior of the home. And so we're going to kind of zoom this in because it's a little small. But we have, you know, roughly 30 different line items that talk about what is happening in this specific project. So subsection is the roof. The category, we actually break the roof into multiple categories. So we've got the roof itself, the gutters, the soffit and the fascia, the exterior trim, and in this instance, the patio roof. Then you've got the next column over is, what are the details of exactly what's going on? So are we doing a new roof? Are we doing patching? Are we doing a roof certification? And then as we move from left to right, from a column perspective, we go into the labor. And we've got drop-downs for, is a subcontractor doing it? Is a general contractor doing it, or again, who we call a contractor who might not be pulling permits if it's more cosmetic in nature. What are the materials? Who's responsible for paying for those materials? And then also a detailed SKU for where the materials are coming from. So from an exterior perspective, you're really trying to think of every single aspect of the house and being as detailed as you can be. And so for this example, we've got roof, we've got siding. And in a specific example of, let's say, the front of the house, one of the notes on this house that we did in Littleton is new cedar plank on the top triangle area of the front porch. So it's trying to be as detailed as you can so that when you show up and your contractor says, well, I thought we were going to put the cedar and wrap the posts. It's no, we talked about the front awning or the top, you know, triangle of the front porch. It's how descriptive can you be? Going down to exterior doors, going down to landscaping, anything on the exterior of the house, also going into garage and talking about all the different doors. So for example, under garage, we've got the interior garage door. We've got the exterior garage door, which is the large entry door into it. Are we replacing the opener, or are we replacing or repairing the side door that gets you from the house into the garage door? Mm. So just really being as detailed as you can be, going, and again, we won't go through every tab.
I'm just curious, before we move on, I see a couple cells up here highlighted in beige. Is that anything important, or is that just a formatting copied over?
That's a formatting copied over. Okay. And then usually for us, that's an area where I want my project manager to follow up on. So for us, we're just going to highlight things in yellow that need follow up.
Oh, so that's more of a visual guide.
Okay. Exactly. Or even sometimes just calling it out and being a little more clear to the contractor for who's paying for what in this instance. So yeah, that's a great point. We'll go over the kitchen. This would be another one that's a really good example for those kind of watching or folks that we can talk to in person, is what's going on in every aspect of the kitchen. So we've got what's happening in the walls or on the walls, and from a flooring perspective, what's happening within each specific area of the property for the kitchen as it's related here. So you've got cabinets. You've got a row for appliances. You've got a row for countertops. You've got a row for the kitchen knobs or the hardware, the faucet, the kitchen sink, the disposal, and the backsplash. So again, reading kind of from left to right, you've got your category, which would be kitchen cabinets. You've got the details of what's going on as it relates to the kitchen cabinets. So this one is replace all cabinets with new boxes. Who's doing the labor? So we've got our contractor's name in there. Who's paying for the materials, which is elevation? Which type of cabinet are we putting in? So in this one, we were putting in white maple. And then we actually have a picture of the cabinets so that, again, the contractor, and a note that we were both chatting about before the show, is the reality is you could have a good agreement between you and your general contractor, but then you have a foreman who's actually going to be running the job and being there every single day, more than likely. You may have a subcontractor who is, let's say, doing the tile work, and then you have the actual guy on his hands and knees laying the tile. So you could have a telephone game of four people deep, which is why I think when some contractors first start to work with us, they think, man, this is a lot of information and maybe a little overload. But the reality is I want to communicate to the person four steps away from me, but that's the guy or the gal that's probably doing the work. And so that's why we have details all the way down to pictures, for example.
Yeah, and I just love that you're actually taking the time to write things down, because there's, even without the telephone game aspect, there's that, hey, oh yeah, we talked about this. And a lot of times, you know, person A and person B can remember completely different things.
Yeah.
Or hey, if it's written down, it gets everyone on the same page. You have a lot higher success rate that way and fewer errors. So I'm curious from here, when you put together this statement of work, and I'm actually more just thinking about your overall workflow from the operation you have.
Yeah.
Is this your acquisitions manager putting this together? Is this your project manager? Is this you? Who's putting together this detailed spreadsheet?
Great point. So when it was me as a one-man band, obviously I did everything, and that helped me refine our system. So our current day staffing situation is we have an acquisitions manager, and she's primarily in charge of helping find properties, helping evaluate on the front end to visit a good deal or not. We work together to validate, okay, yes, this is something we want to move forward with, and then helping us sell it on the back end and some design features. My project manager, this is where he lives. He is the one that absolutely defines every aspect of the project. We will still meet together to make sure we're on the same page of how do we want to finish the house from a layout perspective. And we'll get into it here in a minute, but we have four different styles of homes of how we finish things out for fixtures and finishes. But then this is literally my project manager sitting in the house with his laptop and filling in every aspect of the statement of work after we've gone through the made one page budget to make sure that every single kind of I is dotted and T is crossed, and just moving room to room. Something that we even kind of joke about, but we might pull the trigger on, is having Elevation branded lawn chairs, because you just sit in the room and just look around and make sure you've got every aspect covered. And a kind of little nuance is whatever your personal comfort level is, but we always think of looking at a room from the floor to the ceiling, or from the ceiling to the floor, whatever is your kind of your natural nature of what am I touching? And it helps you not miss things rather than just walk in a room and just kind of scan around.
Mm, that makes sense.
Just little nuances. But again, it's my project manager sitting in a chair, making sure this all makes sense, or us doing it together, or us being, you know, double checking each other's work.
So for a house like this with a statement of work, I mean, how many hours does that take?
That's a good question. This was ended up being a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, about 2,200 square feet with an attached 1-car garage. So if we go all in on number of hours, this is probably a good 4 or 5 hours of planning. Definitely not a full day, but it should be a good half day, whether it's one full stint done at once or whether it's, you know, two, couple of block worth of hours put together. But yeah, a good half day of work to make sure that, you know, you've done a lot of pre-work to this point, but this is really the nitty gritty of making sure that every detail is caught in the statement of work.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then going to in the kitchen, working with the electrical. So what are we doing with the outlets? We replace all the outlets, but a good note example is this for a kitchen is you have to use GFCI outlets when you're working around water. And so it's reminding the contractor we have to use different outlets than the rest of the house. Who's going to be doing the labor? Who's going to be providing the materials? Good example is we wouldn't really have a SKU or a picture of a GFCI because we try to think of those as anything that you're going to buy from Home Depot from kind of a commodity perspective. So sheets of drywall, saw blades, nails, GFCI outlets. I don't care what brand they're buying from Home Depot. We just know we have an account set up at Home Depot. What I care about is the kitchen light, for example. That's something that we are going to have our contractor know. They're going to hang a new light fixture in the same location. We're paying for the light. We order almost all of our fixtures and finishes online on Amazon. So we have the exact type of light, and then we have a picture of that light. So that's where you want to think about SKU and picture so the contractor knows exactly what's going on. And then we can kind of keep going. We'll go over maybe just a couple of more. Mm-hmm. And maybe we look at the main floor bathroom. So this is another one where you are, again, detailing out. We're enlarging this for everybody to kind of see a little bit closer, which is great. And it's a matter of what fixtures are going in the main floor bathroom, for example, putting in a new vanity combo, who's doing the work, who's buying it. In this instance, it's, hey, we need to follow up and make sure and confirm which vanity we're putting in. It's really good to have these conversations with your contractor too, because they're going to be the ones to look at and say, okay, great, I know you want this specific type of vanity, but here's how the plumbing is currently located. So either we need to buy a certain vanity that corresponds to the way the plumbing is coming out of the walls, or he has to change the plumbing to fit a certain vanity and we balance, is that worth it or not?
And that conversation up front is so valuable when it comes to workflow versus, I mean, I've done my very small share of handyman projects at home, and cool, you buy something, you get in there, they're like, oh wow, you know, piece A and piece B don't fit together.
Right.
I imagine on the flip, you know, that's, hey, that has a ripple effect, and that's time and money, and you want to maximize both.
No, it really is. And I think the perfect example of that is IKEA. You know, in a price point home where IKEA makes sense, it looks nice, but the logistics of putting in an IKEA vanity, for example, an existing 1950s home, is you will always have to retrofit plumbing. So we went through that a couple of times with contractors where we have an IKEA box that shows up and it's pretty and it looks ready to go, but then they say, I have to completely change around the plumbing because it's a different style of vanity than how we have it. So you have to go through those trials and tribulations and decide up front. Yeah, it really is. Or another good one that we learned kind of the hard way through trial and error was IKEA vanity. Okay, great. We pick out a Delta faucet. The faucets that are made here in the States don't connect typically without tons of extra legwork and kind of rigging to IKEA hookups. So either you're all in on IKEA for a vanity and a kitchen, or excuse me, and a bathroom faucet, versus maybe you order it through the person who's designing your cabinetry with your kitchen cabinets. You also add on a vanity, and then you can design it exactly the way that you want. So there's kind of pros and cons to each, but we've actually looks nice in certain price points, but we've moved away from IKEA, for example, to standardize our process because it kept coming up where we'd have extra plumbing work or change orders or lost time.
So like, I'm just curious, so you get this IKEA vanity, how much extra time and money would it take you know, someone to come out there and replummet or do whatever they needed to do.
At least an hour or two, you know, and
it's probably, it's a different sub, right? Because you're having the plumber come out to do it versus the cabinet guy install it.
That's totally right. So yeah, if a general contractor is running it, he is going to typically sub it out. So yeah, then you're definitely in the plumbing world. The plumber's going to be more expensive. Getting that plumber out for just a 2 hour fix is such a nightmare. They only want to, and absolutely from their efficiency standpoint, they want to come in, do all the rough plumbing. Then they leave, go do another project. We get it to the point where we're going to do finish out plumbing. They want to come in, do all the trim out and all the finish out. That person does not want to come back. It's not even worth probably $300 an hour for that person's time when they could, let's say, do a whole day's worth of work for $1,000 or $2,000. It's that, you know, kind of snafu in the chain of command. So again, kind of learning trial by fire, but this is how we've refined our system to know exactly what to do and when.
That's interesting. And you can only learn that stuff by doing it umpteen times, and then you learn the stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So it really just goes down to, okay, you go to your next aspect of this bathroom, for example, is what's going on in the shower and the bathtub area. So a lot of our projects, those old cast iron tubs are actually usually almost better than the new fiberglass ones. So we've got great subcontractors that glaze tubs, and they typically look brand new and are super, super nice. And the contractor, we need to know that, okay, great, I have to work with the subcontractor and I'm going to have to glaze. A big area when you're talking about why is the statement of work so important is when it's tile work. So we have our tile in this example for the shower broken up into what tile are we doing for the tub and the shower? What are we doing for the faucet? Schluter is that edging that you put on the outside of a piece of tile that makes it so you don't have to have a bullnose, which is the rounded edge of tile, which is, in our opinion, a little bit dated to that cool metal edge look. What kind of schluter is going in? And also, what type of grout is going in? So you have a lot of variables when it comes to laying tile. Details down to, okay, we're putting in the new hardware. We want the shower head moved up to 80 inches on all of our properties, for example. So we might have that translated to our GC, but his foreman or his plumber doing the work, unless he knows that or it's written down in our statement of work, maybe not everybody moves their shower head height. So we have to document that and put it in. Another little kind of tip is we quickly learned, okay, great, we are ordering the vast majority of our fixtures and finishes, which again is kind of anything pretty or design related on Amazon. We found out that even though it says that it's Delta, if you order online, you're typically going to get something from China, and those valves don't match well, and you're prone to leaks in the future. So one of the things we did again by trial and error is, you know what, it's worth it to get American made Delta hardware from Home Depot, for example, to marry up with the actual finished fixture that you put on for your valve or your shower head to make sure that you're spending a little bit more, but that's obviously worth its weight in gold of not having to come deal with leaks after the fact. So we're always constantly evolving of there is some savings and some efficiency, but it's worth it to put that on our Home Depot run versus order on Amazon because I don't want leaks for clients.
So random logistical question here for you. When you're ordering from Amazon, where does it get shipped to? It can't be shipped to the property, right?
Correct. Yeah, that's a really good logistical question. Right now, we order it to our office.
Okay.
Early on, I ordered it to my home, and my wife definitely was like, why do we have 50 boxes that, you know, show up on the front doorstep? So there is a potentially a little bit of a logistical challenge. Either if you're running your own business, it's worth it definitely to go to your property, because if you order it, we tried to order it to the property. Either it doesn't get delivered, it walks away, it gets damaged by contractors who you know, aren't really caring about, unless it's their specific aspect, it's, you know, a box gets...
Oh, it just gets kicked across the
room. It gets kicked across the room. You know, I think of Ace Ventura when he's kicking the UPS box down the hallway. It's like, I feel like that's happened to our kitchen faucets and hardware from time to time. So yeah, the reality is your home, and I like that because you can then unpack everything. We label everything with blue tape, and then we drop it off at the property at the appropriate time. So it's going, you know, that kitchen faucet goes in the cabinet underneath the sink labeled kitchen faucet, or we're lucky enough to have an office now and my project manager has it all delivered, inventories, make sure it's not damaged and we need to file something with Amazon, labels it, and then we take it to the property at the right time.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so actually great point and super good logistical question.
But I'm just thinking, you know, I order a bunch of stuff on Amazon and, you know, I can't believe how many packages we get. I can only imagine with ordering all these fixtures off of here and then coordinating with Porch Pirates and all that stuff.
It is. It definitely is a challenge. It's something that we feel is worth it, but it definitely is a challenge. So for now we're ordering to the office inventory, everything and take it in. Another great point is if we're looking in this example is at the floor and the wall tile. So you're calling out the tile for the flooring in the bathroom. The detail on that specific aspect is new tile and we're laying it in a brick pattern. So it's how do you want those tiles laid out, which is really important. Again, who's doing the work, who's paying for the materials, which is us, and then where are they getting it from? So we've told them we buy all of our tile from Floor & Decor. They're a great partner. By far, in our opinion, the best kind of bang for your buck with really great selection. We have the exact tile name, and then we've got a picture of the tile itself. And then we do the exact same thing for grout. So you've got your grout. You tell them what's the spacing for that grout. So use 1/8-inch spacers. What is the grout brand and what is the grout color? You've got that in your detailed material list and then the actual physical color of that grout. We still standardize it. So once contractors work with us a couple times, they're getting really good at saying, we know that in this level of finish, it's going to be this stuff on the floor, this stuff on the wall, standardized grout sizes. But I always want somebody to be able to grab this document from us or some of our consulting clients, translate this to their new contractor and not miss a beat. So again, it's really detailed. If you're retexturing a house, it's telling them as detailed in this specific example is we're going to use orange peel on the walls and the ceiling. We do a finish called board and bat, which is kind of like people used to call it wainscoting. We found that in these older homes, when you rip off all the tile on the walls, it's way less expensive, faster, and we think a better product instead of finishing drywall and trying to patch, retexture, and match it up. It's let's do our board and bat finish, but it tells exactly what's going on. So our detailed note, and I'll just read it verbatim to kind of show people how detailed you want, is orange peel the top half of the ceiling, board and bat finish on the lower damaged drywall areas from the door opening behind the vanity, the toilet, and to the shower wall. So you want it as detailed as possible so that there's no confusion.
So do you give them a standardized height on here, or is that just kind of based off of their judgment?
Good question. We try to standardize it to ideally one sheet, which is 4 feet high, but it really is dictated on where did the demo stop of what are they tearing the tile off the walls. But if we can't standardize it, we go to what is one sheet of paint quality, you know, particle board for us to paint. But sometimes if it's tiled further up, we have to go further up. If it's tiled a little bit lower down, we'll still use that standard version.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought that because I liked how you had your shower head 80 inches above, because I've, you know, obviously walked old properties and sometimes rehab properties and the shower head's, you know, 3 feet, not three, you know, it's 6 feet off the ground or five feet off the ground. And you're like, well, you know, everyone points it out and complains about it.
Right.
And those small little things have a huge visual impact on the end user.
Yep.
Or the end buyer.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. And I'll call out one other kind of specific example is if we look at the lighting in this specific bathroom is we've got the light fixture for the vanity and the detail is new light fixture centered over the vanity, which seems basic, but I've walked in a couple properties early on and I'm thinking, wouldn't we want to center the light? But we just now tell folks centered over the vanity, who's doing the work, who's paying for the work. But the big point here is the lights for that vanity bar are facing up because it's fair. No one knows whether you want them faced up or faced down. So we put in there, lights are facing up. And then we have a picture of that vanity light and the light globes are facing up. So it's just how detailed can you be? And I know it probably sounds crazy to some people, but again, if you think of it, just saving yourself one day. And if you're borrowing hard money, that probably saved you at least $100. And then we just go room by room and jump into where we are really going detailed. You know, a lot of them, the bedrooms in this example, I've got three separate bedrooms. A lot of them are going to be the same. So flooring in these ones, we did hardwood floor. So it was refinished the hardwood floor, use a dark walnut Minwax product, and we have a picture of the Minwax stain. If I go from bedroom number one to bedroom number three, it's the exact same. Let me enlarge this for your viewers. It's the exact same look from one room to the next. So totally don't reinvent the wheel if you don't need to. A lot of bedrooms, for example, is copy-paste, tweak one or two line items. So it's not completely reinventing the wheel, but it still makes sense because in that one instance where you're doing a light in bedroom number one, but a fan light combo in bedroom number two, it's still, in our opinion, better to have a tab for each bedroom.
Do you have a separate tab for the master bedroom?
Yeah, we typically do. In this one, we didn't, but yeah, many times we'll have a master bathroom tab. We'll have a master bathroom tab. We've even got it into really any other room. So your laundry and your mechanical of what's going on there, then we'll definitely do that as well. So if you're looking at this specific example, is in the laundry room, we wanted to paint the floor. We wanted to update all the switches and the outlets. We needed to relocate the 220 for the dryer and pull out an old sink. So yeah, ideally you're going in every single room, no matter how similar it is, and going line by line, room by room. And then this actually becomes a printed out document that you use as an addendum to your contract with your contractor. So you've got your agreement that talks about the terms of how you're working with your contractor. The first addendum that we have is the budget. So we're agreeing on the price. This is the second addendum, is you've got your statement of work. And then we also physically print this off and we have it on site. We have a project folder that every deal that we do has a color coded, and people that have attended our live classes will see our rainbow colored folder that we put at every project. And there's a specific section for the statement of work so that, again, if anybody walks in and there's a question, they can physically pull out this, you know, in this instance, it would be like a 12-page document, and we can flip to the bathroom and say, okay, either the contractor did it wrong or we weren't descriptive enough in our walkthrough with them. And it kind of, again, helps eliminate all that gray area on these larger whole house remodels. So it's definitely super involved and super detailed, but we find that it's worth that 4 to probably 6 hours of pre-planning. And it just makes it so there's just very little gray area. When you're doing change orders, then you just add that as a change order document and you also update it in the statement of work too. In that room, if you uncover something and needed to add an extra electrical outlet, you'll put that in as a new line item, print off a new page, attach it to your statement of work and keep moving on. So it avoids that telephone game miscommunication, mm-hmm. and it just helps eliminate gray areas, and having it live on site, I think, is super valuable in addition to it being as an addendum to the contract you sign with your GC to get a project started.
So this might be a tough question for you to answer, mm-hmm. Derek, but looking at, since you've, you know, gone from one-man show to building an operation here and you've mm-hmm. scaled things, mm-hmm. And I'm always kind of fascinated with optimization and getting things to, you know, good enough and optimizing things and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So the, you know, let's just say the 5 hours you spend on here, mm-hmm. how much time do you think having an organized document like this, spending that 5 hours of focus time outlining the stuff, how much time and money does that save downstream? Like if we did two projects next door to each other, yeah. and one was, you know, not as organized like this with the pre-planning up versus this pre-planning, how much time do you think that saves downstream?
That's a really good question. We have identified two things. One is we kind of have a saying that an issue solved or pre-planned or caught today will save us 3 days in the future, because you usually have that day one, which is fixing that problem that you didn't address up front or that detail point you didn't catch. Then there is the at least one other trade that's involved that it affects. So a good example is cabinets. You miss something or you don't pre-plan on something on cabinets, you've got your cabinet day that's burned of it taking an extra day. You've got the effect that it is on the person laying the countertops, and then inherently it might be the person who has to wait to install backsplash. So I think at a minimum, you're almost going to lose 3 days. So if you aggregate that over multiple times in a project, I can't give you a super analytical answer, but I would think 2 to 3 weeks on a project that you could truly cut down. But it would be really interesting to look side by side. What I can tell you is a really specific metric for us is in 2018, in the first half of 19, our average time to finish a whole home flip, and the definition of that for us is normally 3 or 4 bedrooms, 2 or 3 baths, about 2,000 square feet, 1 or 2 car garage, you know, kind of truly your classic residential home in Metro Denver, are close to close. So that's the day I buy it, finishing it, and then selling on the back end was 97 days.
Okay.
So if we look at it, that's an average project length of about 67 days because it typically, we price our stuff really competitively and the market is still a seller's market in today's current conditions. So you're taking about 30 days to sell it. So we're able to do these projects, again, touching virtually every aspect of a property in just over 2 weeks, over 8 total weeks. So if we didn't have this, I'd be curious to see what that would be, but I would definitely say in a minimum 2 weeks, maybe more.
Yeah, and that's actually a much better and more detailed answer than I expected. So thank you. I was just really curious, but I mean, I can totally believe that. And so your rule of thumb is that if a problem occurs, it's usually going to delay that 3 days.
I think so. I mean, there's some things that are simple that if you have, I'm trying to give a good example of something that's really streamlined is, say you've got the wrong hardware for the front door. That's pretty easy. You go to Home Depot if you need to. Yeah. If you're very near the project, you grab a new set of door hardware, ship the other stuff back. But when it comes to something to do with framing, drywall, kind of anything that's not a final detail, it always cascades downhill. You know, get your contractors frustrated at you. They want to move on to new projects. So it's not just you. You know, and I've had this example before where 2 or 3 weeks of delayed finishing can put you close to Thanksgiving, for example. So we had one project early on that got delayed and was going to put us at a finish time right before Thanksgiving. So I totally had to eat another week because I wasn't going to list it the week of Thanksgiving if I didn't have to. So you can also look at kind of ancillary things that come up, and that number could, you know, you could get to a month, but I think 2 weeks is pretty reasonable.
Cool. That makes sense.
Yeah, to estimate. So yeah, so that's kind of our overview on our statement of work when it comes to a whole home. But the take home is plan in advance as much as you can. Look at it before you start the project. Use this to help with your agreement. We always revisit this document after we demo because inherently you open up some walls, you find other stuff that's going on, you refine your statement of work, but then you really have it dialed in and it helps you into your timeline, which is what we're going to talk about in the next episode, is then putting this into work of how long is it going to take you to do this project and then using it as an addendum so that there's no gray area, which cuts down on, you know, conflicts and headaches and everything else that you can somewhat hopefully avoid. And then it goes into how do we finish off the project, which we can talk about our fixture and finish package next. But
so one question before we flip over the next spreadsheet, because I know this question will come from listeners out there.
Yeah.
Is this copy public or is this copy for you and your clients?
This copy is private. This is something that's kind of proprietary that we've put tons of blood, sweat, and tears and mistakes into developing. You know, that IKEA example was just one of many that we've learned and refined. So this one, unfortunately, is proprietary, but definitely conceptually, it's something that we're always happy to talk about with people. But yeah, we don't have this one for, and it's also that we're changing and we'll get into how we're doing our fixture and finish packages, but we're always kind of refining it as well.
Right.
Yeah, but great question.
All right. So the next spreadsheet here, this is your, you said fixture and finish one?
Mm-hmm. We think of this on the front end of working on a idea of not what we like as individuals or our circle of influence. It's truly for the price point of the house that we're looking at or the property or the townhome or the condo. How does it have mass appeal to buyers? And this is something that we really, really try to stay strict to and take our personal taste and opinion out of, so that we can not only create it efficiently, but also appeal to the widest buying audience. So from that, we've narrowed down the way we finish out a house to five different styles, or four styles and kind of two subsets of style that we determine on the front end of how we're going to make this house look when we finish it out.
And so I'm assuming this is kind of like one of your master documents. And then mm-hmm. as you're, once you identify the style of finish you want on the house, you're referencing these links and these, you know, these items
yep.
to go copy and paste into your statement of work.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. That's a great point. So this becomes, you pick which style you're going to use, and that becomes an extra tab on your statement of work that shows every kind of fancier detailed piece that's going into the project.
So you're just basically copying the tab over and pasting yep. into the statement of work?
Yep.
Okay.
Copy and paste. We had that to start where it was originally the statement of work, but we realized that there's really great value in having these separately so that you can look and decide which style you want. And then the other thing is typically every 6 months, we're updating this so that we are on top of design trends, but not overdoing it. And the big goal here is to not start from scratch and reinvent the wheel every single time. So really every aspect of each project, once you pick one of your four levels of finish, is completely dialed in. The changes would be is, let's say if Amazon discontinues something, you have to redo your selection. And then another one that we find is really doesn't hold you up, but also helps give you some customization on a house is the backsplash. So that's definitely something that we look and we do change from time to time on a property, but everything else is 100% standardized and then updated every 6 months. So if we're showing your folks in your listening community is...
Sorry, one more question before we go through. How do you determine the latest styles? Is that 10 hours of HGTV a week? Or like, is it, me picking styles would be a horrendous activity for me to do. I'm fine living in a white space, wearing the same clothes every day for the rest of my life.
Right.
So it comes to like picking out stuff. It's just,
yeah.
I'm horrible at it. So I'm curious, like, how or who do you have to do this?
That's a great question. It's a combination of actually a couple people. Initially on, it was myself. And when I did that, I just tried to buy or subscribe to as many design magazines as I could. I was on Houzz, I was on Pinterest, I was on anything that would be current design related online. Definitely a lot of hours watching HGTV. Early on, it was something that I do think is important because that's what your clients watch, your prospective yep. buyers. And from that, we'll talk about it in a second. And that's why we now have a farmhouse tab. I would have never thought of that 2 or 3 years ago, but being in tune to current design. So definitely subscribing to, you know, different local publications, both digitally. And I think there's something nice about actually thumbing through design magazines. So we've got myself. I am 100% a realist and know that primarily if there's a female involved in buying a property, that person will have the biggest influence. I really try to think of it from a woman's perspective. So on my staff, we have two women that have a great design eye. So I run this by them. And then we also rely on our staging partners. So we have 2 or 3 different go-to stagers that we use that are, in my opinion, expert designers anyways. And so we're honestly, they're kind of that end decision maker and definitely our tiebreaker to help vet what is current and what is cool and what do people want that's the widest possible audience. So that's like 3 or 4 different people. We don't have an interior designer per se. But another person kind of on our team is we have a kitchen designer, and that's also a woman right now, and she's fantastic. And so we run stuff by them too. So it kind of starts at the top, if you will, but it definitely gets finalized by having 3 to 4 other females help us stay on track of what's kind of current.
Okay, great. Thank you. I was just really curious how you put this together.
Nope.
Because I could see this. I mean, this would be a very valuable document just because, hey, it's all plug and play and copy and paste the stuff you need. And it's probably 95% done for each house.
Yeah, it really is. And I just went to, so the different styles that we have are, we've got the farmhouse, which is inspired by Fixer Upper and Chip and Joanna Gaines, which everybody yeah. loves. Ironically, I've got a connection that I grew up with Chip and played football with him. So it's kind of a weird full circle that now I'm thinking, I know that guy. And
so
realize,
is he really that fun and goofy?
He honestly was. He was hilarious. There's one episode where he puts on the Baylor football helmet and runs through a wall. Like, he did that. I grew up in Dallas, Fort Worth area, and he truly did that. So I'm happy to see him so successful. But them as a team, and obviously Jonah, they've got great design taste.
Yeah.
So why reinvent the wheel? I mean, people love that, and they're smarter than me and on TV for a reason. So we came up with the farmhouse style, which is more of a lighter white color palette from a painting, both interior and exterior, and then bringing in the black hardware type of design. So looking at our fixture and finishes, we have all the different rows and columns to where you have your bathroom vanity light. So you've got your first column is where is that specific fixture and finish going? We have a picture of it next. So everybody's on the same page. We have the price point so that we can help budget when we're doing our one sheet budgeting on the front end. We do that tally mark of how many fixtures and finishes are we doing so we can match that. The next column over is quantity. So you can change that if you wanted to, of are we doing one light? Are we doing three of the same lights? Where are we getting it from? We always try to order not only from Amazon, but definitely have it fall under the Prime category. You do not want to save $8, but then realize it's going to take you 7 weeks for that light to get there.
Yeah.
So you always default back to Prime so you can get it within 2 days. And then we've got it as a live link so we can click it, add it to our cart. And then what I love kind of from an administrative standpoint is that for the whole house, if we've got 30 items of our fixtures and finishes, which are your light fixtures, your fans, your faucets, your door hardware, your cabinet hardware, whatever that may be, that gets dumped in a cart. I can allocate that dollar amount, which gets charged to my credit card, as the exact amount of money we pay. And then we really balance that to what did we budget. And when my bookkeeper is reconciling, we put the property name and address, and it makes bookkeeping and reconciliation super easy
on
the back end.
That makes a lot of sense, especially once you get more than two projects going on.
Yeah.
It makes the expense tracking a lot easier. Can you scroll down? I'm just curious, since because I see light fixtures, fans. Okay, so this is a comprehensive list here.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you've got surface mount lights, which are on the ceilings that are small, surface mount lights that are medium, surface mount lights that are large, pendant lights, small, medium, and large, chandelier, outdoor lighting, cabinet hardware poles, cabinet hardware, individuals, the price point. So yeah, we're scrolling down under just the farmhouse fixture and finish packet. We have 36 different items that we use on a consistent basis if we say, yeah, this house makes sense to design it as the farmhouse style.
So depending on these different categories you have, do you have corresponding paint colors and tiles that, hey, this, you know, this gray or this white goes with farmhouse, this tile goes here?
Yep.
Okay.
We do. When it comes to paint, that's been one we've really standardized. We have, and we update them once a year, but we have two wall paint colors. We go with Sherwin-Williams primarily, or we have our clients match it. So we know that, honestly, our paint colors only change once a year. So we do one paint color that we do on the walls in the bedrooms and the bathrooms, and then we do one wall paint color everywhere else.
What's the trendy color this year for
elevation? So right now, we're using Sherwin-Williams Passive is a super light gray that isn't over-the-top gray, because I think everybody could get a little bit bored with that. Might almost border on having a white look to it, but it's just that super faint gray that I think people really, really like. If we feel like it's more of a suburban home where you don't need it quite as contemporary, we use accessible beige, and the name doesn't do it justice, but again, it's really nice kind of taupe, super light, nondescript, so that people look at it as it's a nice custom color, but you want your wall color to blend in. You don't want it to pop unless it's, let's say, a mid-century modern house or something more specific.
Okay.
So I think really good question. So we've got farmhouse. We'll go to our high end. For us, that's usually properties that are selling over $500,000. And we've got black hardware for our high end. And so we go down the line of two or three different types of kitchen sink options, two or three different types of kitchen faucet options, toilets, shower hardware, door hardware. We've got four or five different lighting options. We've got fan light combo options. We've got low profile options for those basement bedrooms where you don't want your light fixture hanging down much. We've got pendant lights. So again, under the higher end, we've got 28 different types of fixtures and finishes. And you know, something I was also thinking that your listening community might like to know is, I think you can still put out a great product, but not have to break the bank from a budget perspective. And that's where we really feel like we fine-tune and put out a really great product, but keep it budget conscious. So for example, we have a really cool chandelier that we just put in a property that was in a Denver suburb of Englewood, for those locally that are listening. And it looked really, really nice. And it was $239. So not over the top. I mean, we're talking cool LED.
Was that one just down there?
Yep. So we just scrolled past it. So okay. We've got this chandelier that we put in a property and the final sales price point was $615,000. And I put a $239 light. Again, it takes time to find which ones. We've ordered some in our learning process that, yeah, it's in that price point, but it looks like a $99 or an $89 light. So you got to kind of be careful. And some of it is trial and error, but you don't have to spend a ton. I mean, if we're looking at surface mount lights, you know, you're in the $30 to $60 price range. For fans, $100 for nice fan light combos. If you are looking at vanity light bars, we've got a 4-light vanity bar that we put in these type of half million dollar properties, $149. So you don't need to go crazy on what you're picking out, because there's that big threshold of, you could put in a $600 faucet, but once it is functional, looks really good, works really well, you're never going to get that money back.
Yeah.
So we really try to dial into that. Another one that we have, because not only do we like it as a company, but we feel that mid-century modern properties are relatively prevalent in the Denver market. And when done right, they can go for a premium. So this fixture palette is different.
How much premium do you think they can...
I knew you were going to ask
me.
Yeah,
well, you should have had that. Now I'm really curious.
I know I should have had that. You know, I would say if you're looking... Well, here's a good quick anecdote. I guess it really is neighborhood centric.
Yeah.
So those out there listening locally, is there's a little tiny pocket in central Denver called Crisana Park. And there are amazing mid-century homes in there. Literally, and I've done them right across the street in the Virginia Village and Virginia Vale neighborhood. So regular ranch, 2-story, you know, 1 level plus a basement.
Yeah.
That has a mid-century modern design feel to it. Probably around 1,500 to 2,000 square feet, you're getting 3 to 4 bedrooms, 2 to 3 bathrooms, good size house. You know, we just did a couple of those and those are selling in the $500,000 price range. House literally across the street, a dividing line in a different neighborhood. So we always want to be sensitive to that. But this neighborhood of Crisana Park, and my number's a little dated because I can't ever afford to find them at the right price, but single story, no basement, 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom, done really well with a classic mid-century finish, can go over $700,000.
Wow. Huh.
So granted, you're talking neighborhood, but I still think that the design style really, really makes a difference. We try, unless it is in a Crisana Park, but we've done 2 or 3 mid-centuries in Littleton, which is a southern suburb of Metro Denver. We've done some, you know, just right outside the Denver nucleus. And, we go mid-century, but we don't go over the top because we still want to appeal to the audience. I don't want to only keep 15% of the market happy that are the purest, if you will, but I don't know if I'm going to sell to them every time. I'd rather appeal to 80% of the audience that likes that design finish, and I don't make the purest mad, if you will, but for mid-century. So I can't put an exact percentage on the premium. I just know that if we take a mid-century house and put in farmhouse finishes, we actually would drive people away rather than be inclusive of having a bigger buying audience. So for mid-century, we bring in many people call it bronze, is probably the most ubiquitous term that people can use to describe mid-century. So you've got the, you know, different types of bronze hardware, and you're not paying a huge premium on the price. So for example, on some of the faucets, on the kitchen faucet, you're in the 100 and, you know, depending upon which one you go with, you're at $123 for a nice 3-hand or 2-handle three hole, you know, fixture versus on the other one, you're, you know, closer to $100. Or again, we're going mid-century. You've got different styles of lights and light globes, but you're not breaking the bank. You're still at the $127 price point for a four globe vanity light bar. And you're just using different unique features. So we have a lot more options in here. So we're already up to scrolling down. Here's a perfect example is the Sputnik light in a mid-century modern home, which I don't really remember how they correlated that term to this type of light, but it looks like a starburst, which are, you know, really cool. You don't have to break the bank. You can get a cool Sputnik light for between $100 and $300. But that specific fixture really, really pops when it's in a mid-century home. So you definitely want to do those types of things. So in mid-century, we have another 38 different line items of types of fixtures and finishes that we put in our properties.
Yeah, and just like you were saying, I mean, I can see this where, you know, most people can't. I mean, these prices, I don't see anything that's a drastic difference than what we looked at on the other tabs.
Yeah, nothing crazy. Because again, you're not really going to get that return. And I always preface this with, my company doesn't really focus on $750,000 and up houses. If you're doing, you know, one of these properties, or if we were doing one of those homes in Crissana Park, we would definitely spend more. But you don't have to break the bank, I don't think. We have a rental level of finish, which is more in the brushed nickel and kind of the chrome type of family. Although trying to be on current design trends, we are seeing a lot of the shiny chrome correlate to higher end product. So here in 2020, we'll start to look at that and say, hey, there's been some really neat things that we've seen out there with people using chrome. But again, we want all the different price points.
So shiny chrome is making a comeback?
Yeah, I've seen it, and I honestly was kind of surprised, but we're going to do a test. We've got a condo coming up in Wash Park that we decided to go shiny silver or chrome on, because we've seen it in a couple different design magazines and really expensive, like Parade of Homes type properties. So we're always almost using us as a guinea pig to a degree. I'm never going to go totally crazy, but close on deciding which level of fixture and finish to do. So we're going to try chrome, but more so on the condo and townhome, we've got another tab that's kind of that starter home or, different rental properties. So we've got five different styles that people can pick from. Each style has, 25 to 40 different types of fixtures and finishes that you could put in your property that, again, this is hours and years of refinement. And again, we kind of try to update it every 6 weeks of, okay, we've thought about this on the front end. What's going to be the widest buying audience? Who can we appeal to? And how can we have all these things at our fingertips? And then to link it in from the construction perspective, again, we want to pay for this. So I'm not paying a markup to a contractor. I'm ordering it myself. I can control the timing. We put it on a company credit card, so we get, airline miles or cash back to reinvest in marketing or whatever we're going to do. My contractors don't have to carry the cost on these. And it truly just seems to be a really good win-win for everybody involved.
All right. I like this. So starter house, rentals, mid-century, high-end, and farmhouse.
Yep, and farmhouse. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, we feel like that covers, let's call it 90% of the prospective type of properties, we could buy. Again, everybody can have their own design flair that they can put on it. And a good example of that is we're in the process. I don't have it for the viewing audience now. We're kind of refining it, but it'll be ready here for early next year. We found about 15 to 20, we call them unique design areas, of what can you do to make sure that your house doesn't look like the generic thing that many other flippers are buying from Home Depot, and how can you, in a normalizing market, or some people might call it correcting or whatever you want to call it, when it's not quite as easy to put a house on the market on Friday and have an art contract on Sunday, you got to put out a better product. So for us, what's a cost-efficient way to put unique design pieces to our properties, not break the bank, and make sure your property looks different?
It's fixtures and finishes.
It's fixtures and finishes. We're going to have another tab that will be not specific to a certain style, but a certain area. So where can we use barn doors and put in that type of hardware? Where can we put in another good area is old homes that have siding, that the siding is good, but you can't re-side and you want to take out a window to, let's say, make a kitchen more functional. We've actually found that by using cedar as an accent on the front of the house to make it have nice earthy tones to it, make it look kind of contemporary. You can actually put cedar in where that window used to be, and it's a design piece. We've used, you know, literally pickets from a fence. So the lumber and the materials and the labor probably cost me $100. We don't have to re-side the house because we can't find that siding. You put more cedar on the rest of the front of the house, design feature that's probably all in for $300 or $400. So 15
to 20
different things.
And that
creates
a lot of like pop and interest. And
yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Or little things like shiplap, another kind of Chip and Joanna thing. But where can you add that that's looks nice and clean and is really straightforward and cost efficient? We've got kind of a way we do our fireplaces that I think make a lot of sense for people. That is an all-in add up of $400 to do fireplaces with, stacked stone on the bottom half, order a mantle off of Amazon that costs you $100 and shiplap the top. You're all in for an extra $400-$500 with labor. Makes a huge difference. So we're going to kind of have another tab here shortly that will be something that you can put in any home, not just a farmhouse or not just a rental or not just an upscale property. So just always trying to evolve. So that's TBD or coming for 2020.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
All right. We'll have you back then when you got the, version, whatever of this. I don't know what version you're on.
Yeah.
6 months from now.
Yeah.
Great. Any other things to talk about in this spreadsheet?
I think this spreadsheet pretty much covers it. It's really just thinking of what are our 4, 5, or 6 ways to finish out a house. Don't reinvent the wheel. Use the same things that have a nice design feel to it and save you time and energy and money. And then, revisit it once or twice a year.
Great. And then as we wrap up this episode, because I know this episode and the previous one, at least from my perspective, kind of go hand in hand.
Right.
What's the next episode start focusing on?
Yeah. So we almost think of this as, yes, we're using it during the day-to-day, but it's still almost more of a planning tool. So the next episode, we're going to be looking at our tracker that in the past was a 115 step-by-step process of every single thing you need to do to flip a property, from finding the deal, analyzing the deal, 4 phases of rehab, getting to the closing table and writing a thank you note to your buyer. I mean, that many steps. I'm really excited because we've moved to a software called Monday.com. I'm sure people have seen ads for it. We've taken the time to create a custom application on Monday.com to how people can use it for fix and flips. And so we've taken that 115 step spreadsheet version that was still good and automated it and put it into Monday.com. So we'll go through that live, and we just are only 2 months into that, but it's a way more intuitive way to do it that not only can my project manager do it on the spot, but we think that we can use that to scale into other markets from software. So we'll really go through how we run the project and how you keep track of all these moving parts from a tracker perspective in our next episode.
Great. Well, we look forward to learning about that and seeing it. So everyone, thank you for listening and watching. And Derek, thank you for your time again.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.